Hello and welcome to Facility Resilience, where we discuss the latest trends in facility design, operation, and maintenance, in addition to operational resilience strategies for senior management. I'm your host, Jennifer Getz, and today I'm joined by Sarah Powell, founder and principal consultant for SP2 Strategies. Sarah has spent over 20 years in the risk and resilience space as a researcher, practitioner, and leader. She continues to be focused on building the resilience of individuals, teams, and organizations on a local and global scale, even when that means transforming existing cultures. Sarah, thank you for being here with me today.
Awesome to be here.
So I'm really excited for our discussion today on human resilience and how to build strong teams. So to kick this off, how would you define resilience?
Well, I really think that the superpower that humans have, and by that I mean Homo sapiens sapiens, our species, is really around adaptability. We can adapt to changing conditions and situations. We're really good at that. And I do believe that that is what resilience is all about, ultimately, that our ability to flex, adapt, especially on kind of a mental or psychological level, so that we can continue to move forward and grow and adjust to changing conditions versus resisting those conditions or developing a sort of rigidity about them.
So, what are some qualities that resilient people demonstrate? I know one of the things that you mentioned is really adaptability. Is there any other qualities that come to mind?
Absolutely. There's a whole set of resilience factors, which are sometimes opposed to risk factors around resilience. But I think it's really important for people to understand that first and foremost, humans are remarkably resilient beings. Most people are going to be perfectly resilient. So sometimes we talk about this word as though it's some rarefied, difficult to achieve quality or something like that. But it's really like your immune system. It's this entire system that as you develop a growth mindset, as you are willing to learn and adapt and change, and you're comfortable with the fact that things can happen, that there's uncertainty in the world, and you kind of have a little bit of an optimistic mindset. That optimism, interestingly enough, is a resilience factor that does help. Although, of course, it doesn't mean that if you're more pessimistic, you can't be resilient. I think what I'm seeing a lot right now is the conflation of things like grit. Grit has to do with having perseverance and passion. There is no association between or necessity of having grit in order to be resilient. You don't need to be a gritty person in order to be resilient. So I think that that's really important. This is totally accessible and attainable by all people. And in fact, most people in a post-disaster environment, especially major crises, are going to be resilient.
That's wonderful to hear. And talking about this, after a crisis happens, how does human behavior impact business resilience?
So we're talking about resilience at the individual level. And then there's the team level, so smaller groups of people. And then there's the, organizational level, which, so I would put business resilience and operational resilience into that organizational level. There's more to it than just individuals and how resilient they are when you're talking about a bigger organization. And the same thing for a nation that's resilient, or even global resilience. So in those cases, you're really starting to talk about systems and how those systems themselves are resilient. But at the end of the day, humans are the ones making decisions, choices, preparing or choosing not to prepare for uncertainty and for difficult events in the future. And I think that you've got kind of a mindset that people develop in their lives, and that can dictate in many ways their behaviors, right? So I'll give you an example. If you, as an individual, are comfortable with the fact that bad things can happen at any time, or that there's unexpected things that can happen at any time, there are things you can start to do behaviorally to create less stress for yourself in the future. And that's like retirement planning, right? Or setting some money aside, saving some money, even creating just a little emergency fund so that if something unexpected occurs, you're prepared for that, or you have less stress. And I often feel like it's a gift to your future self. Like you're going to be resilient no matter what, most likely, but just take the pressure off of yourself, like help yourself with that adaptability, the less stress you are experiencing, the more adaptable you can be, and the more quickly you can be adaptable. So it's the same with an organization or a business. The businesses that have a leadership team in particular that are really willing to get engage with things like scenario planning and futurist, foresight work, working with consultants or working with, having an in-house person who's really serious about understanding strategy by looking at current trends, by looking at what's happening, understanding the threat and hazard landscape. These are really, really helpful, like tremendously helpful, because the whole point of business resilience is being able to be adaptable in the same way that we are as individuals. But there's a lot at stake. I mean, there's a lot of other systems, and there needs to be that level of transparency and thought leadership around that. At the end of the day, people need to be prepared. And that extends to a leadership team being prepared for unexpected things occurring, being prepared to have a mindset shift very quickly. And an example of that can be that there's a changing geopolitical landscape. I really do believe in all hazards preparedness, because we can't always predict the thing that's going to happen. A lot of people didn't believe that a global pandemic could come along and be so disruptive. There are some of us who had been planning for that for many, many years, but it doesn't really matter what it is. You have to be able to consider, what if our supply chain squeezes to the point that we can't, work within this no slack system that we have built? What if something happens that creates a change in our enrollment, for example, in higher education? What does that look like? Can we plan? Can we shift strategy really quickly to meet the demands? So I'm talking at a very strategic level, but there's a lot of human behavior that enables that kind of pivoting and kind of adaptability.
You mentioned that leaders are the ones that set the tone and help set up kind of the framework for what will be needed to create a resilient team. So, how can leaders continue to build and foster a strong team?
So leadership happens at all levels, right? If you're the head of a facilities team and you're in facilities management, I've seen some great leaders in facilities management who do exactly what we were just talking about. So you've got that organizational level, and it certainly is helpful if you're in a facilities management leadership role to have the support of a senior leader like your COO or something like that, where you're getting the funding you need. But if you don't, even if you don't have the resources you need, you can prepare your team by getting them really prepared for those emergency situations, understanding how human cognition works in crisis. People can't think, and they certainly can't think deeply from an executive function standpoint when they're in the middle of a highly stressful situation, especially if it's novel. If it's a novel, unpredictable situation, they're going to have a really hard time thinking through the steps of what to do in that situation. So you got to practice the procedures, have checklists, do things to sort of take off the cognitive load for your team and really prepare them for the fact that anything could happen. Like, there's a lot of denial that goes on. I come out of emergency management. I always had great partners in facilities who were willing to consider, the kinds of things that could happen, and willing to consider putting systems in place to ease the suffering and ease the stress if those things happen. And part of my job in emergency management was to also help them with the people side. So let's say you're in an organization like an institution of higher ed, and you've got dormitories that you're responsible for, and you lose your primary source of heat in the middle of winter, which totally happened to us at one point at Temple University. And my job is to figure out, where are we putting these students? Are we setting up a mass care site? What are we doing while the facilities team is solving the problem and able to deal with that piece of it? So partnering across silos and creating kind of coalitions with other leaders and other stakeholders in your organization is a critical piece of this for all leaders. You can't just do it by yourself and function in this little silo alone. You really need to have a partnership with your human resources folks, if you have emergency management or public safety or environmental health and safety, and not just have a relationship with them, but really practice with them and really prepare with them for those kinds of situations. It's that leadership that's able to really engage with the unexpected happening, because that's what everyone remembers, right? Nobody remembers that for 170 days of the year, you kept everything running beautifully. They remember how you managed the unexpected, crazy shutdown of whatever system or a public health emergency that you had to manage, whatever the situation looks like. That's what people remember. It's worth the time and effort to really prepare yourself and your team for those situations.
So where do you think organizations really struggle the most when it comes to creating and building a resilient team, and what advice you might have for them?
So I would start out by saying that there's a lot of mythology out there about how people react in emergencies. And it really depends on what we're talking about. So of course, we know about fight or flight. We also know that sometimes people freeze. It's kind of helpful to understand the differences between those automatic responses to stressful conditions. I mean, these are stress responses. They're evolutionary. They're highly important for us. I mean, they've kept us alive. We thank you very much, fight or flight and freeze. We need you. The freeze response is usually what happens when people perceive, or their brains perceive on some level, that that death is imminent, or the crisis is so overwhelming that they don't have any resources to deal with a situation. And, you know, 9/11 would have been a great example of times where people report having had a freeze response, or in different kinds of active shooter situations, like the threat is just so great and so overwhelming. So yes, there are incidents like that where you might have a danger of a high number of people engaging, or their brains automatically and through the autonomic nervous system engaging in a freeze response. But most of the time, do not assume that people are going to panic. They're not. They don't. They really don't. And what happens is they panic when they don't have information and they think that their survival is at stake, or their family's survival is at stake. So really understanding crisis communications, I think, is a critical piece here. And leaders should train themselves up on crisis communications, because at any point, the head of facilities could be responsible for helping form a message or some kind of communication to people. And they should be prepared for regular, consistent communication on a regular cadence to say, here's the update. This is what's happening. This is what you need to do. Information is super helpful. It should always be paired with an action, if possible, for people to take. People really want and need to be told something that they can do that's in their control. So we're going to have an electrical shutdown. It's a planned shutdown for Wednesday. Here are the steps for you to take, because you're going to get those lab scientists, or you're going to get people with their minus 80 freezers, and they're really super worried about, what does this mean for me? And the more you can manage that in advance, if it's planned, better. If you choose not to, you're going to have a lot of upset people. And people, you know, I think sometimes folks who might be planning the response maybe take for granted how well people understand the implications of what's happening. So, you know, trying to work with communications team to craft these messages and to really communicate clearly is super important. So the communication part is a big one. What else are you kind of curious about when you think about these situations?
I'm thinking also in general about hybrid and remote work. Mm. So when you think about creating a resilient team and the difference between having that resilient team both on site versus in a more remote setting, because a lot of facility executives and building owners and operators right now, that's pretty top of mind, how to navigate that kind of landscape, and especially if different emergencies come up and they need to rely on their teams to perform to the best of their ability.
Yeah, this is a great one. This is coming up so much lately. And I'm going to, so the way to divide this up is, we all know that there are some jobs that you really need to be in person to do, right? We just know that. There's no question about it. And
yeah,
a lot of those jobs fall into that category that of facilities management types of jobs. Does that mean people need to be on site 5 days a week? In some cases, yes. In other cases, no. And it really depends. So it really depends on what the role is. So I led a global team for a large tech firm for a brief period, where every single one of my team members, and this was all environmental health, safety, and wellness functions, each team member was on a different continent. So we were truly a global team that was also mostly, you know, remote. Did they have to go on site sometimes? Yes, absolutely. But it was totally possible to have a highly resilient functioning team that was well connected and really could work and plan together. Absolutely possible. Any kind of hybrid or remote arrangement, and they really are different. I really feel like we kind of combine the two as if it's the same thing. It's really not. A hybrid team is still working in person for a period of time. So one day at home a week could equate to a hybrid arrangement. That's probably not going to be a very disruptive situation to deal with. I mean, it's very easy to imagine that one day a week, someone can do administrative tasks at home. We have the technology to do it. Not a big deal. A fully remote team is going to need to have a lot of intention behind how they connect and how they work together. But leaders need to be extremely intentional with how we create cadences, regular check-ins, whereas before you might be able to get away with not having one-on-one meetings with all of your direct reports. It is absolutely essential that you're seeing those direct reports at least once every 2 weeks now in a one-on-one. And there's a lot coming out about how employees need that in order to engage. And you need, as a leader, to know how to give people meaningful feedback and meaningful just assistance and support. I do really empathize, though, with the fact that in facilities, a lot of these folks do need to be on site 5 days a week. And so hybrid's not even really an issue. But I will say, I was the director of emergency management during COVID, and I was at home 90% of that time for 18 months. So yes, I assisted and, you know, organized and helped run vaccine clinics, and I was on site for those kinds of operational needs. But a lot of the work I did was totally remote.
Yeah. Have you seen some major changes already just as a result of COVID with how people are approaching, specifically leaders are approaching disaster management?
I don't know. I feel as though a lot of people do what normally happens in disaster scenarios, which is there's an initial surge of support and planning and preparedness, but people get a certain fatigue very, very quickly. It's like we all should be doubling down on making sure that we have the most resilient systems possible and that we're really building in more resilient systems that are new and that we've learned from, but people often don't do that. It's almost like that's over, near miss. We got through it. We survived. Now let's just continue to do what we've always done. And so the most resilient orgs and leaders are going to really take a pause and inventory what they learned from this time and change their practices. What worked 5 years ago may not work today. What worked 5 years ago, if you got through that with unscathed, maybe you were just incredibly lucky and you still really could do to create better systems now. So that when it happens again, and it will happen, whether it's in your lifetime or not is besides the point, but it will happen. Are your team members, are your leaders, or is your organization, is your community going to be more prepared for that and even more resilient? So by resilience in that sense, once again, like some organizations are not going to be resilient. They failed. They went under. They had all their eggs in one basket. They didn't have any flex in their supply chain. Like something happened that really accelerated their collapse. Okay. That definitely happened. Some orgs just got through by the skin of their teeth and managed to survive. And others really thrived and were able to capture the moment. And that was, those are the people who were ready on some level. Like imagine yourself, you're super stressed. If you're super stressed and you're like blown away by what's happening and you're still like, how is this happening? How is this happening? Like clearly you're not thinking about what you could be doing to pivot or take advantage even of the situation. So always wild to see and hear about leaders who are able to have that kind of presence to sort of say, this is a unique moment. We can really thrive in this moment, even though it's something that's quite scary and unexpected. That's really, that's the goal.
Absolutely. And Sarah, this has been such an interesting topic for all different kinds of organizations right now, because of course everybody wants is focused on creating resilient buildings, but a lot of resilient buildings are created by having resilient teams and staff that are there to maintain them. So, is there anything else that maybe we haven't touched on this subject that you think is important to include in a discussion about this?
You know, I do think there's one thing, which is in a lot of these fields, there's a sentiment that young people coming into the field, quote unquote, don't want to work or are not committed to work. But I hear that don't want to work a lot. And one of the things that's really important for leaders right now is to understand some of the shifts that are occurring. And they were underway before the pandemic, and the pandemic has just served to accelerate them. Number one is that we no longer live in a world where people are content to just do a rote job without aligning it to some level of purpose in their lives. And in a lot of ways, this makes sense, right? So we're leaving an industrial era. Think factory floor. You know, the industrial era had a different way of managing people that, whether it was optimal or not, was the prevailing methodology for management. That no longer works. We're shifting out of that time. You really need to think about management or leadership 2.0 or 3.0. I've seen people kind of coming up with different ways to think about this, but helping your teams find meaning in what they're doing. How are they contributing to the organization's success? It's not just about being an electrician. It's you're keeping this place, you know, alive. You're keeping this place moving forward and as a space for people to enjoy. Like, what is it that you're doing in your job and how does that connect? And I think the other piece that's certainly been a piece of this story for a long time is that we need to pay people. It's so much more expensive now than it was even 30 years ago to live. And so paying people a wage that we were paying them 30 years ago is just not going to be acceptable. And the example that comes up a lot is around the nursing shortage. We've been having a nursing shortage for decades. And the reason is we probably need to pay nurses a lot more to do the work that they do. So, you know, there's the level, there's that issue of compensation, but I really think we can help people find a lot of purpose in what they do. And leaders have to be intentional about it. It can't just be like this dismissive thing of like, oh, they don't want to work. What's wrong with them? Like that generation. I mean, there's a reason why Gen Zs are in droves becoming entrepreneurs because they go into these organizations, they're treated like widget machines from the industrial era, and they don't want it. They don't want it. Nobody wants to be treated like a widget machine. So for those of you out there who are facilities management leaders, and you're doing something different, and you're engaging your people, and you're helping them align meaning and purpose for, in what they do. Those are the stories I'd love to hear more about. We need you. We need you to set a tone for a new era because we will never not need facilities folks. We could automate so much, but we will always need that human to assist and to help and to think strategically in difficult situations.
Absolutely. And I want to hear those stories too. So I will
Absolutely.
let you know, Sarah.
Thank you.
But no, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you today. And thank you for coming on.
Yeah, Jen, this was so great. And thanks to all my friends out there in the facilities management space.
Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode of the Facility Resilience Podcast.